I'm calling this session on Song of Songs, Be Loving. As we are talking about be whatever in each one of our books that we're going through, I say that because marriage is under attack. It's probably no surprise to you. Beginning with the Netherlands, some 10 or more years ago, marriage has been redefined. It happened in the United States, 26th of June, 2015. Honestly, I never, ever thought that was going to happen in my lifetime, that we actually have a different definition of marriage. Same-sex marriage was declared legal in more and more states in the United States, and it was debated in quite a few of them, and illegal in others, but when the Supreme Court made the decision, it basically superseded all those other laws so that same-sex marriage has to be required by every state in the United States. And that whole decision was even celebrated at the White House by lighting up the White House in the colors of the rainbow, you know? And it's, you know, where is it going to actually go? If a man can marry a man and a woman can marry a woman, that's taking a pretty big step of a difference between, in terms of a definition of marriage, right? Yes. Isn't it a shorter step for one person to marry several people? For one man to have four wives, five wives, five wives? Doesn't it seem more natural for a man to have five wives than it is for a man to have a husband? I think we're gonna take a step back on this. I'm expecting that polygamy will be legalized in the United States. Where is it actually going to go? I mean, we see marriages. Like Bill Cosby, I remember saying, everybody has a bad marriage in Hollywood. Everybody except Bill Cosby. I remember telling my wife that like 20 years ago. A little did I realize that he was actually committing adultery with his maid for all these years and others and covered up. And then the more recent one, the issues surrounding, I won't get into all the details, but Bill Hybels and just overstepping his bounds with women on staff and that kind of thing, and their senior pastor ending up resigning over all this. That happened in 2018. We're losing our moorings in terms of what is right and what is wrong. We'll be studying Isaiah later, but let me just jump to Isaiah 5, verse 20. What sorrow for those who say that evil is good and good is evil. Friends, that's happening all the time. People are saying evil is good and good is evil. That dark is light and light is dark. We used to have a common understanding of what darkness was. It's when you turn the lights off, morally speaking. But what sorrow for people who say that bitter is sweet and sweet is bitter. And this whole area of sexuality, there is a huge, huge cover-up. Nobody's going to tell you that homosexuals have 19 times the higher rate of suicide. You ever hear that before? These sort of facts are actually not, they're just not allowed to be out there in the public domain. But you study it, you'll see that there's a lot of pain people are going through with this. I've tried to help some of them through this kind of pain. And it's very deep. And some of you, I suspect, in your counseling ministries, you'll be trying to help people like this. But there's laws, and where I come from, in California, there's laws against even suggesting to someone who comes to you for help with their sexual same-sex issues to help them get out of that. There's laws preventing that now. And where I come from in California, and this verse is basically about California. I could go on and on with all the craziness that comes out of California, but things like in children's textbooks, not referring to a mother and a father in children's stories anymore. Cannot do that. You can only refer to parents. And you say, well, that's just one state. California is the most populated state. California affects not just textbooks for publishers. They're not going to just publish a different set of textbooks for California. They're going to change them for all of them, right? To suit California's agenda. And then the agenda affects the entire United States. Honestly, what happens in the San Francisco area, where I'm from, affects California. What happens in California affects the whole United States. What happens to the whole United States has a great impact on the rest of the world. So you should care about what happened in California, not just because I come from California, but because that is the trajectory of the future. In light of all that, and in light of the fact that we've had problems with sexuality since Adam and Eve, we have the Songs of Songs. We have what I call a dialogue of marital love. If you want the Song of Songs just in one phrase, that's my understanding of it. One day it dawned on me, and all these different views on what's happening in Song of Songs. Oh, this man and this woman, they're talking to one another the whole time. And the love that they show for one another is in a unity of the book. It moves toward marriage. And so we're talking about a married couple dialoguing with one another in a model that should be a model for us. Now, some of you are not married, and so you say, well, this doesn't relate to me. I say, this relates to you even more, to those of us who are married. Why? The biggest decision I made about marriage, I made before I got married. Do I see any amens from some of you married folks? When I got married, done deal. You know, I'm with her the rest of my life. Thank God for that. But we're going to get walking out on that one. Oh, you're just changing the temperature. Okay. Yeah. You're right. We need more fans for this book. The key word for the book... Sorry to draw attention to you. The key word is love. And specifically, love in the context of marriage. All right? Is it the right to say this is romantic love? Well, this is about as romantic as you're going to get in the Bible. But when we think about romance, we tend to think about feelings and sexuality and all that. We don't tend to think... This book is talking about far more than that. It's talking about commitment. Yes, it has evocative language in it and stuff too, but it's really a fantastic book. Key verse, I belong to my lover and his desire is for me. You see how she is delighting, chapter 7? She's delighting in the fact that she's delightful. And so I call the book Be Loving. And we're naturally curious about sexuality from our earliest ages. little kids understand there's differences between mommy and daddy, you know? But traditional Judaism didn't allow men to read Song of Songs until age 30. Wow. So if you're under age 30, you're free to leave the class right now. Yeah. Nobody's going to take us up on it. Everybody's over 30, huh? So I think this is actually a dialogue of marital love. And I go against what a lot of our modern scholarship says here. I have a more traditional view on this. Many of our modern scholars, including some of our faculty, I believe, but I don't know, see this as a collection of many different marriage poems and sayings, and don't necessarily see a unity to the book. But I think there's actually a progression of into this book that goes from courtship to wedding. They get married in the middle of the book is what I'm talking about. There's a wedding procession, chapter 3, that ends with a consummation of their marriage, chapter 4 up to chapter 5, verse 1. So that it moves from a puppy love to a love untested at their wedding. And then that courtship to marriage is followed by the latter half of the book, where there's a growth in marriage. Part of this can be seen in the two declarations of the woman. She says in chapter 2, verse 16, "My lover is mine, and I am his." Do you see what she puts for first? Basically, I got him. And yeah, I'm his too, you know. But then when you get to chapter 6, verse 3, and I also put it up there, chapter 7, "I am my lover's, and he is mine." Her focus ends up being more like, wow, he is delighting in me. Her focus ends up becoming less selfish, if you will, in it. And so there's a love that's tried and true. There's a growth. And then to those who say, well, this is a bunch of disconnected love poems, I would say, well, it starts at the vineyard. Both of them are at the vineyard in chapter 1. And then they're both at the vineyard in chapter 8 as well, the last chapter. So there's like bookends in the book. It starts at the vineyard, ends at the vineyard. It's kind of like going with the person you love back to the place where you met. And thanking God for the years and the growth that's happened since that time. So I think the book is actually answering the question, how can marital love become all that God's designed? That is about one of the most relevant questions in your life and mine. Especially since most of us get married. I've never met anyone who wanted to have a bad marriage. You know, I've never met anybody with the intention of divorce when the person got married. And I think what we find in these two major sections of the book are two ways for marital love to be all that God designed. And here's the first one, the first half of the book. Wait. Wait for sex until marriage. I often say it this way when somebody asks me, why should I wait for sex for marriage? I say, well, do you want to marry someone who's having sex with someone else? Do you want to be married to someone who's having sex with someone else? I have never heard anyone say, yeah, that'd be a good idea. You know, variety, you know. Da-da-da. Nobody wants that. So if you don't want to marry someone like that, maybe you should be a person like that. Maybe instead of living together, let's say before marriage, and proving that you'll go to bed with someone that you're not married to, that's what living together does. Most people don't think about that. If you go live together with someone that you're not married with, you're disproving the very thing you want to prove. If you ask people, why are you living together? They say, well, we want to just prove our love. We don't want to test our love. You go, well, you're just... And when people ask me about it, I'll just say, well, you are proving that you're willing to go sleep with someone that you're not married to. Is that what you want in the foundation of your marriage? As the foundation of your marriage? When you think about it, everybody should say, no, actually, I don't really want that. What you want is you want to prove fidelity before you're married. Because, hey, if he or she can control their passions before marriage, I bet they'll be a lot better at it about it after marriage. Don't you think? Doesn't that make sense? And I think that's essentially what the song is saying here. So it's a dialogue of marital love that that goes to the wedding in the middle of the book, and then it grows in marriage. And by the way, the very first verse says, this is Solomon's Song of Songs. Solomon wrote, was it 3,001 songs? No, 1,005 songs at the top of page 426. Okay? You don't have to listen to all the other 1,004. They didn't all make it into the Bible. You get the best one. I don't know if Solomon picked it as the best one, but certainly the Hebrew community did. They said, this is the best of all Solomon's 1,005 songs. And it relates to marriage. Should that be any surprise to us? Because that's something that relates to at least most of us who God has designed for to get married. Starts off, kiss me and kiss me again, for your love is sweeter than wine. How fragrant your cologne. Your name is like, it's spreading fragrance. No wonder all the young women love you. Now, you'll notice it in this New Living Translation. I think your NIV is going to do the same thing. Many of your translations, it'll put little titles that show you who's speaking. That is not the same as the superscriptions in the book of Psalms that's inspired. You've got inspired superscriptions, but in Song of Songs, this is our best attempt for the translator, from the translators, to talk about who's talking. Now, generally you can tell because there's a switch in pronouns here from masculine to feminine and that sort of thing. But generally it's pretty clear. There is a little bit of a difficulty when we get to chapter 5, verse 1, because they have had sex for the first time, and the end of verse 1 in chapter 5, verse 1 says, eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. Okay, who's saying this? This is not the man, it's not the woman, someone else. My translation, NIV here, says, friends. This is a friend saying this. Really? The friends are there on the honeymoon night? You know, I'm like, well, I'm not so sure. This, what, was somebody under the bed? You know, you've heard these stories, right? Two people under the bed, they walk out afterwards, you know. I don't think it's friends. I think it's more like God. I think it's God who's delighting that they delight in one another. So after she says in this very pictorial way that they've consummated their marriage, and he says, I drink wine with my milk, and oh, lover and beloved, eat and drink deeply of your love. I think it's God. I think that's God who's saying, I'm pleased. I'm really pleased with this. So that's kind of, I think the basic idea here is that it's saying exercise premarital sexual restraint so that marriage can be enjoyed to its fullest. Allow love to blossom in its own time. You see this in chapter 2, verse 7. I jumped over here to slide 39. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires, she says. That's her advice. That's her advice after, in chapter 2. And speaking of chapter 2, where should you sleep when you get married? The night I got married, I said to my wife, I said, hey, let's have a pattern reading the Bible every night. You know, we just got married today. And she said, well, yeah, where should we start? I said, I think Song of Songs is a good place to start. Because that's where people usually get married, you know. And we come to the bed. And I think, boy, what? Do I get on the right side? Do I get on the left side? Never done this before. My wife was thinking the same thing. You know, we've been married for a couple hours. It was the first time to ever go to bed with someone like this. And And I said, you know what? There's this verse, and I opened up my Bible, you know. Chapter 2, verse 6, it says, his left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. And I said, if I'm laying on the left side of the bed, there's no way I can do this. There's no way I can do this. You've got to be on that left side, and I've got to be on this right side for me to embrace you with my right arm. So ever since that night, 35 years ago, I've been sleeping on the left side. She's been sleeping on the right side. So I told her, you know, here's biblical support for where we're supposed, what side of the bed we're supposed to sleep on. But anyway, there's this sense of joy that comes for this woman because she's preserved herself before marriage. And she says it again in chapter 3, verse 5. Don't arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Second time. She repeats it. Then there's this wedding. There's this carriage that comes. There's this all these skilled swordsmen. And it's very clear that this is the day that Solomon's getting married. Verse 11. Come out to see King Solomon. He wears the crown his mother gave him on his wedding day. I take it that what we have here is the wedding day of the king. So they get married. And then he starts talking about her in the most poetic form. Your eyes are like doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats. You men need to try this. I've tried this with my wife, you know. You know? How about your belly is like a heap of wheat? That's the one that really, you know. I don't know how they do wheat in your country. I think they were doing wheat like an hourglass, like this. You know, where I come from, wheat is like in a big circle, you know. So that one doesn't work so much in American context. And she uses this imagery of a garden. And she says, come into your garden. They consummate their wedding, their marriage. And that's where this thing where God says, eat, drink, and imbibe deeply. So I think to answer the question, how can marital love become all that God's designed? The first thing that that this book says is a wait for sex until marriage. Okay, so they get married. There's the chapter 4, moves on into chapter 5. And then secondly, work. Work for a good marriage. So how can marriage be all that God wants it? First of all, wait. This would be my counsel for those of you who are not married. Wait, and then work. Wait. Get married, then work. Work at the marriage. If you're going to work at anything, work at your marriage. Work at your marriage because your ministry is going to come and go. You'll probably just switch ministries and that sort of thing. The longest ministry you're going to have is with the person you're married to. And it doesn't really dawn on us a lot that if we're going to invest in anything the most, invest in our marriage. The most, more than a ministry, and that means you've a lot of choices we need to make. All right, there's much to be said here, but you guys have done the work on this. I'm going to skip kind of right all the way to the end, slide 71. So here's how I think you can sum up the book: the love story of Solomon and the Shulamite wife. From courtship to strong marital love shows the need for premarital sexual restraint. There's the first application. And the effort required for growth in marital love, the second application. One application for singles, one application for marrieds. This book's for every one of us. So to answer how marital love can be all that God wanted, the wait for sex till marriage, that applies to every single person in the room. And then to work for a good marriage, that applies to every married person in the room. So I think the main idea of the book is be loving by waiting and working. If you want it just very succinctly. We all know that marriages are in trouble. They really are. So this book tells us to exercise premarital sexual restraint. Chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, and then you get to the end of the book. She says it again. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. It's like, wow, this lady, can't she say anything new? No, not on this one. She's not going to say anything new. She's going to say what's most important three times. And the virgins until marriage is a great, great... I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but this is the kind of thing you can waittillmarriage.org is a website that will help you with this. It's especially needed in the West. In the United States, fornication, in other words, people who are having sex before marriage, that was 1% of people in the year 1900. By the time we get to the year 2002, is 95% of people were virgins when they got married. And this is definitely the case when I got married back in the 80s. When my wife went to her gynecologist before we got married, he was shocked to find a virgin. He brought his colleague. Hey, this is a virgin. Wow. Wow. You can go online to commit adultery. I'm not going to give you the website. But they have users. Well, I guess that's an appropriate way to say it. Users, right? And São Paulo leads the world, New York City after that, etc., with people that can go online to commit adultery. Whereas Proverbs says the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense, Proverbs 6. But I'm jumping over into the book of Proverbs. And we need to take a break, and then we'll get into the book of Proverbs.